Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this meeting of the Joint Constitutional Review Committee. I think the agenda before us is consideration of minutes of the previous meeting, briefing by the parliamentary legal advisors on the 2010 Public Commission, adoption of the draft report on the 2009 public submission. I propose that we start with apologies first and then go on to the briefing by the parliamentary legal advisors on the 2010 public submission. Thereafter, we go to our minutes of the previous meeting and then the adoption of the draft report on the 2009 public submission. What apologies do we have? How shall the beer? Let's apologize. I don't know where we're going to. Oh, and China, both from the NCOP are attending the meeting of the Appropriations Committee. And Mr. Snell, and Mr. Schmidt, and Mr. Watson, and Ajay, is what? Of six. All the others are attending another committee meeting. Okay, you have to wait for my quorum. You don't form a quorum? You do? And the PA is not here at all. Any apologies from the PA? Okay. And then who? Smart. You see, the secretary, as we had instructed previously, sent out notices to all members, asking them to confirm if they will be coming or not. Did you confirm?
Very good.
Yeah, but the problem is some of us don't respond. So all of us who are here did confirm.
Yeah.
Because that assists us, as I said, to determine whether we should go ahead with the meeting or not. Because we need a quorum for certain meetings, for decisions to be taken. For instance, today we are supposed to adopt the report on the 2009 submission and the minutes of the previous meeting. So what do you suggest to do? Can the COVE assist us in that regard?
When I walked into the offices, it was very thin and dark.
That's in the High Court.
Yeah, luckily not.
Because I thought the ANC has managed to come up with its own fair share.
Well done, yeah.
But then again, if the ANC can still assist the other parties by mobilizing more, that would...
What other committees are sitting?
Now we need one.
Finance.
Appropriation. One day.
So while the chief whips are considering what to do about ensuring that we have some quorum, let's proceed to entertain the legal opinion from the advisor. We are in your hands.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Osile Matabate, and I'll be doing the first legal opinion, which is committee reference number 2. And the opinion is from Batlhakwane ba Manzinyama. Batlhakwane have made a submission to the committee requesting that Section 25 of the Constitution be reviewed. Section 25 of the Constitution is the property rights section. According to them, Section 25 in its current form is delaying transformation. They argue that according to, or in terms of the multi-party negotiations in 1993, it was agreed that apartheid would be phased out incrementally, and the time has come now for land reform to take place. And they argue that in order for that to happen, Section 25 has to be amended so that the willing buyer, willing seller approach is phased out, since it is not affordable to government. It's too expensive for government to engage in willing buyer, willing seller, in a willing buyer, willing seller approach. This submission raises policy issues and not legal issues, and as such, it's for the committee to decide if that policy must be amended or not. Thank you, Chairperson.
Any questions for clarity? Any member who has anything that he or she doesn't understand? Well, obviously, today we are meeting merely to get an understanding of this submission, and also to hear the views of the parliamentary legal advisor, not necessarily to discuss. And I do want to make a comment that it does seem as if this submission continues to be made every year.
Yeah.
And you might want as a committee to consider the advisability of holding some public hearings on this one. Just a thought, I thought I should share.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, reading advice number 6. But Chakwane submission raises a policy issues and not legal issues. I'm of the view, therefore, that a policy decision must be taken by the committee. So, Chairperson, I think I will agree with you in terms of us looking deeper into this. If they say a policy decision was taken by us, it means there's work that we still need to do in trying to find out what must be regulated flowing from Section 25. Thanks.
Yeah. Chairperson, thank you. I don't think the committee can take a policy decision. I think it's up to the political parties to take a policy decision, you know. And my opinion is that this Section 25 is a very emotional. So I would rather refer it then back to the political parties, and it's up to the ruling party whether they want to call public hearings for this, on this Section 25 conducted by this committee, because I don't think it's going to be easy public hearing. So rather refer it back to the political parties and then come with a mandate. But I don't think we can take a policy.
Yeah, well, we have to thank the COP for making sure that we do have a quorum to take this decision.
Well, it's up to every political party.
No, because of Bloom's entry into the
COP.
Take your seat, Mr. Bloom. In fact, I had, I don't know, because the call to the public is for them to ask committee to review certain sections of the of the constitution, and anything I would imagine affects policy. Anything that has to do with the laws of the country has something to do with policy. For the advisors to say no, this is the policy issue, not a legal issue, I am not so sure if they are being that helpful to us. It's either because usually we would say that they would say this issue is properly provided for in any event in other legislation, and that therefore it doesn't call for a review of the part of the constitution that is being we have been called upon to review. And they would say therefore that it's not necessary, because this concern is already catered for in other legislation or something like that. But their advisors, the real decision lies with us. And the fact that a matter may be emotional can't be a reason for us to shirk our responsibility to consider whether or not there's a need for a particular section in the Constitution to be amended. But as I had indicated, we are not today to take a decision on what to do, but merely to understand what the submission is about. We shall give ourselves time in the course of time to apply our minds as to what needs to be done about each of these submissions. I was just throwing a thought that I would invite members to consider. Any comment to the comment that have just been made from the legal advisor before we proceed?
Chairperson, just to say that we would advise where really the issues that are raised anywhere else or are addressed anywhere else in the law. But in this particular case, what the submission is requesting for is a change in policy, because he argues that the policy as contained in Section 25 is not assisting the process of phasing out apartheid, and the only way to do that is to change the policy as is contained in the Constitution. That's why, Chairperson, we are saying that this requires policy changes, and that falls within the purview of yourselves and not us. I think that and when we say the committee, Chairperson, it is from the understanding that the committee would be getting mandates from the parties as to what is going to, whether first of all the policy has to be changed, and if it has to be changed, what the new policy would be. So that is really what we mean. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think the response is still too academic and diplomatic. I think what you need to tell us is that you have looked into the constitutional clause. You have looked this argument against the constitutional clause, and as you looked into that, and then you looked into the policy that is in existing in translating the constitutional clause, and then you then recommended to us, you are recommending to us that it's not a legal issue. I don't know how, but we need this committee, the Constitutional Review Committee, needs to take to do a policy to address this. To me, which I'm not a legal persona, it then says there is a gap that you have found, which is not addressing there's a deficiency in the clause, hence, and there's a vacuum in whatever regulations that are policies that have been made after the Constitution. So hence, we are then saying we must then do this. But I'm not sure also, because we are a constitutional review, ne? There is justice and constitutional development. When you say we have to, that's why I'm getting to where, what the chairperson is saying. You say, if they're giving it to us, and we have to review a policy, and policy is legal. So we are wishy-washy on what we are advising to us. Maybe it's because of the Tony and sensitive issues. Thanks.
I may be not correct, but I think the Department of Land Affairs have already announced that they want to move away from a willing, able, and buyer position. Now, the position is, as soon as they do that, somebody will challenge it. And then, if they challenge it in terms of Section 25, we must wait to see whether Section 25 will stop that. If it doesn't stop it, then this becomes valid. But we don't know now. You know, I think we must wait. The department, the government is progressing on that road. Let's see what's happening. Why changing the Section 25 if we don't know it's even necessary to change it? It's not been challenged yet.
When the person making the submission is challenging Section 25, I thought what they would say
is that insofar as
they understand it, this particular section of the Constitution does not disempower government to be able to distribute land. Because they are saying the reason government has not been able to address the inequalities over land is because of Section 25. I thought then they would be saying, as far as I understand, Section 25 doesn't prevent government from doing that, or it does, and then they would advise us accordingly. I thought that's what you would want to establish. Maybe let's ask them to go back and have a look again at this. Because we cannot necessarily be hamstrung by what government departments are stating they intend to do when there are people who believe that whether or not policy will come to address a particular issue, the fact remains that a section in the Constitution is working against those interests, that possibility. But I think let's not finalize anything yet, but just ask the advisors to take into account what you just said and see if they will be in a position to come up with anything new or whether they will still remain with the position that they are holding at the moment.
Yeah, just
Chairperson,
I'm going to ask that I do that with the researcher, because I think that would not be necessarily looking at legal issues, but at facts, factual, you know, what is happening on a factual basis. That I'm sure can be done, because I think the point that is being raised again and at Chairperson is that there is a policy that is contained in 25. And that policy provides that the government has to, if it wants to get a piece of land that is owned by a private person, that it has to enter into negotiations with that person and agree on a just and equitable price. And this person or these people are arguing that prevents government from bringing about land reform, because prices are then escalated and such things. So that's why I'm saying that is not a legal, it's factual. But that can be done, Chairperson. I just request that be done with the assistance of the legislature.
Can we proceed to the next submission, which and send to the committee reference 3? This question will be...
Thank you, Chair. The as you've indicated, the opinion I'll be speaking to is Committee Reference 3, Opinion Reference Number 7110. The submission is from Dr. Naidu, and there are various submissions that is made in the one document. The first one that I'll be speaking to is the submission in respect of Section 92, sub 2 of the Constitution. And what Dr. Naidu says is that when we read Section 92, sub 2, he's saying that that reading gives the impression that the Cabinet is accountable to Parliament, but they're not accountable to the President. Section 92, sub 2 states, members of Cabinet are accountable collectively and individually to Parliament for the exercise of their powers and the performance of their functions. Now, Dr. Naidu says if we read that section, then it means, or it implies rather, that there's no accountability of the Cabinet to the President. What I've set out in the opinion before the members this morning is basically a constitutional overview placing Section 92 in context, because when we read the Constitution, we must never read the sections in isolation. If we do that, it could be that we lead to a wrong conclusion. And so the opinion sets out the accountability in the greater context of the Constitution. And what comes out is that if we look at Section 85(1) of the Constitution, we see that the executive authority is vested in the President. Section 83(1) amplifies this provision by providing that the President is the head of state and the head of the national executive. Section 84(1) affords the President the necessary constitutional and legislative powers that are necessary for him to operate as head of state and as the head of the national executive. In terms of Section 91, sub 1, the President, the Deputy President, and Ministers comprise the Cabinet, with the President holding the position of Head of Cabinet. Now, I state that to raise the point that the Constitution uses the word, for instance, Head of Cabinet. That by itself implies that there's a subordinate relationship between the President and the members of the Cabinet. And intrinsically, in what is implied in the word head is that this seems to be...
One able to follow here. We have the memorandum CR3 and Roman figure 1. It's not that far.
Three in brackets 2 for something.
Okay.
And that's in the middle of the opinion. Brackets 2, mine is.
So the document that we're using is the one that is like this one. Committee reference.
Committee reference 3, that's right?
Nothing in
reference number at the bottom, 7110.
7110. That's the document we should use.
I think 3 would be sub 1.
Mm-hmm.
3 sub 1 is... Let me just put 72 on there. But there's no number. But the one that I'm speaking to is committee reference 3. Reference number at the bottom, 71/10.
Why are there this confusing number of documents? How did it happen?
Oh, yeah, but it's in one document.
In one document.
What we do? One part of it.
Two opinions in the one.
Uh-huh. He's the president. For what? They came like it. Yeah, I think wherever they are, look for this document. Reference, committee reference 3. Maybe while you are at it, the next document will be committee reference 331. The one you'll be using by changing. Is that the one you'll be using? This one. Okay. And then the next one will be committee reference 3. Bracket 2. We'll be using that one on its own. And thereafter, we'll go to committee reference 4. Presented by Vanara. And the next one will be reference 5 by Mr. Vassin. The next one will committee reference 6 by Mr. Vanara. We all have them like that?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, may proceed. Yes. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm on reference 3 with no bracket next to it, just the 3. So coming back to what I was saying, Chair, looking at the different sections of the Constitution, there seems to be a master and servant, for lack of a better phrase, relationship between the President and the members of the Cabinet. So if we look at Section 92.1, it says the Deputy President and Ministers are responsible for the powers and functions of the Executive assigned to them by the President. That in itself means that there's a head of the Cabinet, which is implied by the Constitution. So obviously there's accountability built into that. And that is why I state when we read the submission by Dr. Naidu, it does at first glance seem that they're not accountable. But when you read the Constitution holistically, you see that indeed they are accountable to the President. It's further amplified by the performance agreements that the President and Cabinet members have entered into. So I'm sure my view is that in this respect, the submission by Dr. Naidu does not require a constitutional amendment. I'm of the opinion that there's sufficient in the Constitution to impart that there's accountability of the members of the Cabinet to the President. That's the first part of Dr. Naidu's submission. Dr. Naidu then goes on to make further submissions, which are broken down into various parts, which in my document I have just collated to get some sense of what he was proposing. So in his proposal, he says Chapter 9, and then he goes through a whole lot of sections, 81, 83, 184, 185. But in my document, page 3, in point 2.1, I'm basically just in the A, B, and C bullets, merging what comes out of Dr. Naidu's submission. So the first collective point is that the Commission of Gender Equality must be abolished, and that its function should be absorbed in the Ministry for Women, Children, and Persons with Disabilities. B is that the South African Human Rights Commission and the Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural and Religious and Linguistic Communities be merged, and C, that the merged structure created in the above should incorporate the functions of the Pan South African Language Board. Now, having looked at that, it all relates to Chapter 9, and what Dr. Naidu is just basically asking is for an overall of what's happening with those bodies. Looking into this issue, I had regard to the report of the ad hoc committee, the National Assembly Committee that looked into the review of Chapter 9 institutions during 2009. And then going through that report in preparation for this onset or guidance to this committee, I discovered that what Mr. Naidu was actually putting before this committee was what was contained in that report of the review that was conducted in 2007. So what has been further set out, in my opinion, is what comes from that 2007 review. And I think, very importantly, the review committee of 2009 was not to say against the submissions. There is a comment by the review, in the report rather, on page 40, which I quoted in the opinion, which says, the committee, and that refers to the ad hoc committee of 2009, notes that the process of amalgamation will neither be easy nor speedy. Apart from the National Youth Commission, these bodies are established by the Constitution, and amalgamation thus requires significant constitutional amendment. In order for such amendment to be effected, and I underlined a bit, Parliament and the Executive must give it due consideration. And I think, Chairperson, that's really what I want to emphasize to this committee. Should this committee decide that that amendment is needed, that they indeed favor the submission made by Mr. Naidoo to look at amending the sections of the Constitution in respect of Chapter 9, then it is a substantial amendment that's required. It's not a word, and a consequential. It's really something that Parliament and the Executive, I think, need to meet minds on. And I think that I amplify, in my opinion, that view of the 2007 review. The second part to the Chapter 9, with Mr. Naidoo's submission in respect of the Auditor General, Chairperson, I would really just like if the committee members could guide me on this, because when I read this submission, I couldn't find any suggestion, because it says, what Dr. Naidoo is saying is the Auditor General plays a critically important role in ensuring that monies are spent in a sustainable manner and that there's good governance and no corruption. He doesn't then amplify it to say, I would like this and I'd like this to be done. So I couldn't really gauge from him what he was saying. And if the members feel that I maybe missed something and there's something else that I should look at further in respect of that part of the AG, then I will take guidance from the committee. But you'll see on page 3 at the bottom under 2.3, in my opinion, I state that I'm not quite sure from my reading that is proposing a constitutional amendment for this committee's consideration. Moving on to the third part of Dr. Naidoo's submission. He refers to Section 186 of the Constitution. And what he's saying there is he's saying that the Public Service Commission should be abolished and that its function should be incorporated into the Health and Science Research Council, and that certain functions should be referred to the CCMA. Now, once again, looking at the submission, reading the review report that I referred to, the 2009, this also comes from the 2009 review. And when I looked at it, what comes out is that its issues are, for instance, salary negotiations, bargaining, all those kind of things. And the way legislation has been drafted is that the General Public Bargaining Council is where government issues are dealt with. It's not dealt with in terms of the CCMA, in terms of current law. Many years ago, there was a schedule to the Labor Relations Act where government matters were before the CCMA. That schedule has since been repealed, and they're no longer part of the, government disputes no longer fall under the jurisdiction of the CCMA. That was done away with a couple of years ago. So what Dr. Naidoo was now saying is that we should revert back to the position where government goes to the CCMA, but yet the General Bargaining Council was created to repeal that position a couple of years ago. Also coming from the submission 3, in the last paragraph of my opinion, I state that on page 84 of that review report in 2007, the Mpai Commission's recommendation in that report is that the Public Service Commission should be located also in the Office of the Presidency, but that it should remain independent. And that's also an issue that Dr. Naidoo is raising. But we also have to be considered of whether or not there's going to be a level of independence as what is envisaged for the Public Service Commission. But Chairperson, those are really decisions for the committee. Those I want to steer away from a word such as a policy decision, but I think it's a decision that the committee needs to deliberate on, and if the decision is taken to take the proposal forward, then obviously that would be within the committee's competence to do so. Thank you, Chair.
that comment on that section 193.3 because the submitter is just commenting on the audit and run. So there's no
section. Oh, one by one. Yeah. The magic comment now on 192.
Yes. I wanted to comment
on the comments from Mr. Naidu.
All of them,
holistically. No, just it's a general remark. Thank you. First of all, my apologies for being late, but I think that the committee could not find more secret intervention as this one. I couldn't find the room. Secondly, my apologies. Then, no, we met over there. No, you're right. I can't find this place. Then my apologies for not having attended as much as I would have liked to. So there have been concomitant meetings or committees at any given time. I just want to react to a general statement made by the advocate, again, on the function of this committee and the interrelation between this committee and the executive. The entire 1996 Constitution was written without any input from the executive and without any input from Parliament. It had nothing to do with the executive and nothing to do with Parliament. It was adopted by the Constitutional Assembly. My reading of the Constitution is that we are the heir of the Constitutional Assembly. The process continues through this committee. So, and we are a committee of Parliament. So Parliament and the Constitutional Assembly have merged in a constitutionally designated committee. So I do not, as a preliminary issue, I do not think that any extent of revision of the Constitution which can lead to any extent of amendment require necessarily the interaction with the executive because it is not in the constitutional scheme. But otherwise, I do agree on the policy consideration expressed by the advocate. I don't see any of these amendments being desirable.
Also, the chairperson, just a general question. You know, I do not know Dr. Knight. What I see is the MWEB email address. Now, you know, should we not, you know, consider that if people want to address this committee, there must be some sort of a better reference who's doing this. You know, he could have used 10 people and then just submitted under his name. I don't know. But, you know, should we not sort of trying to organize our submissions in a more proper fashion? You know, that's maybe for the future, but I do not know this man. I haven't seen a CV. I don't know where he lives. I don't know whether he's a South African citizen. I've got no idea, you know, what he is all about, whether there's somebody behind him. Should we just take this on face value? I don't know. You know, are we not opening this committee to all kinds of abuse from whoever wants to abuse the system as it is?
Yeah, there's a comment that invites comments from the committee, not necessarily to anyone in particular. Roy?
No, I was just asking, any members in proceeding with the recommended change
to the proposals. I'm just curious regarding the very first proposal, amendment of section 92.2. The performance agreements that you mentioned, were they actually signed with? It's between the minister and the president. Which would clinch the deal anyway in regard to that particular section that clearly establishes who's the boss.
Let's keep on remembering that we just were asking questions for purpose of clarity. We're not about to take any decisions on whether these proposals merit a review of the Constitution or not.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to find out from the legal guru to say performance agreement in line with the head of state signing or causing the cabinet members to sign performance agreement
in order for him to monitor them. Is the performance agreement legally binding them? Can it be challenged by any minister to say there is no, it's not legal? Thanks.
Thank you, T. I don't think that the question centers on legal. I think that when we look at performance management, it's really about how you're doing your job, how you're performing. Now, the relationship between the president and the ministers is one that comes from the constitution. The president gets the right to appoint his cabinets, and I think that that is where that what I allude to in my opinion, that master and servant relationship. And I think we have seen it in the past that we had a deputy minister of health with the former minister, with the former president. We not performing, president not satisfied, the president has the power to remove you. And I think that is the constitutional principle that underlies that relationship. I think the performance contracting is really just for the president to set a benchmark of what he requires of the members of cabinet. Thank you.
Maybe let's just be broad and allow everybody to comment on any part of the submission.
No, my comment was just that on section 192 to 30, he's just commenting on the audition. He's not proposing any amendment.
They noticed that there is no. But what is the comment on what Corinne of race? The extent of the identity of the person making the submission. How relevant is that? And what is it? So, do we want to certify, for instance, ourselves that indeed this is a South African citizen? Or do we want anything more than that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that
Dr. Kornoff brings us back to what I consider the core issue of this committee. Preliminary, yes, I do agree there should be South African citizens, but that's the only criteria we can put, and that all it takes is a phone call when one receives the submission to check on the ID number. But I think that more fundamentally is, do we need to be engaged by each and every Joe, Dick and Harry who are South African citizens on the most absurd ideas that they have in mind? That's not my understanding. My understanding is that we are appointed politicians. We need to review the Constitution. In so doing, we can get input from the public, as any other committee does. Huh? But we hear them. We are not driven by their inputs. The difficulty is that other committees have a bill before them, and the public inputs are on the bill, and that's what limits the scope of the public inputs. We don't have a bill. We've got a general discussion. We've got the Constitution. I saw the draft report to the same to Parliament, which I hope is a draft report. I haven't followed. But there is written that this committee decides that the Constitution does not need to be reviewed. That's not correct in terms of terminology, and that highlights the point I'm trying to make. I think it should read that we have reviewed the Constitution, because that's what we are required by the Constitution to do. We must review the Constitution. We have reviewed the Constitution, and reviewed the Constitution, we have decided it does not require any amendment. And that's what we need to do, an annual review, and every year we report to Parliament whether or not we feel the Constitution should be amended, how it should be amended. And that is important to positioning this committee what it should be doing, which is better processing constitutional amendments. So if we take greater charge of reviewing the Constitution by setting at each meeting a chapter and seeing how we feel, and then we feed within that agenda of ours, rather than being dictating the agenda by public inputs, within that agenda we feed whatever comments we receive, then I feel that the comment and the correct concern raised by Dr. Kornoff would be addressed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You covered by Dr. Ambrose.
Yeah, Chairperson,
I don't know, but in terms of the our brief, is that we have to call on, make that advert in terms of the public to suggest what can be reviewed from the Constitution. But then digging deeper into the public, ne? I'm not sure whether we do, I'm just checking on the question in terms of, do we say South African citizenship should give us what they think, what are the clauses that can be reviewed. So I'm not sure when we dig deeper then to say who exactly is this person. If we then say no, we'll find out that you're not a South African citizen. I'm saying, I was saying, let me just get this clause first in terms of our mandate, and then we can then go back and say, is that question relevant or not? Thanks.
Yes,
thank you, Chair. I'm covered by what Mule is saying, because another thing that I was going to ask is that Dr. Kurenhof is maybe suggesting that a person must come to this committee first so that we know that particular person, or I think maybe we have to create a criteria that is going to show us, and we need to know what is really said by the Constitution. What is the Constitution saying with this regard? But maybe we'll need some criteria, because I don't think maybe we can call them to come to the committee also.
No, I think Kurenhof is saying that at least we need to understand who this person is, some kind of identity, not just someone coming up from nowhere. I think that's common sense and it's relevant.
Maybe, Jefferson, maybe we need some criteria that will make us to identify, to know the identity of a particular person.
When we issue the invitations, people must give us their contact addresses as well.
Yeah.
But I think the point made by Ambrosini is also correct, that we are a constitutional review committee. It's our responsibility to review the committee. And to assist us in reviewing the Constitution, Constitution, we invite the public in terms of the rules to make submissions. Then we consider the rules. Even in the absence of submissions from the public, it still remains our responsibility to review the Constitution. And then once we review it, maybe in terms of the submission, we decide whether or not the Constitution has to be amended. That is the decision at the end of the day that we have to take. I think that was correct. But the question of how then we go about doing that is something else that we have to consider. He's made this proposition before, that maybe let's take the Constitution chapter by chapter, or choose the relevant chapters that we require that on our own. But for the moment, we are dealing with the submissions. Maybe when we have time, because you yourself have been unable to attend meetings because we all belong to a number of other committees. It makes it a bit difficult for us to meet as regularly as we would want to. But for the moment, we are dealing with the submission. I take it there are no more comments or questions for clarity on this particular submission. So we proceed to the next one, which will be presented by Jenkins. Committee reference, CR3. In paragraph 1, reference number 7210. I beg your pardon?
In the same issue.
In the book?
On the same submission.
No, it's a different one. Same person. Oh, same person. But this is committee reference CR31. Reference number 7210. Am I right? On the
unfortunate thing about mine, they are separate. Yours are combined, so I'm confused with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It is the same Naidu chant.
Yes.
It's a political Naidu.
Thank you. Good morning, honorable members, chairperson, and colleagues. The crux of the request of Mr. Naidu in this instance is focused on Section 6 and Section 9 of the Constitution. Section 6 of the Constitution deals with languages. Now, in the submission of Mr. Naidu, he is suggesting that we make English the official working language of the Republic of South Africa. And then that there would be an obligation on governments to advance the languages spoken prior to 1994, when we had the Democratic Revolution. He also suggests that there should be, where practical, there should be an obligation on governments to promote the use of electronic communication. And this obligation goes to all spheres of government as well as the traditional leadership. He also suggests that there should be a schedule attached to set out all the languages spoken prior to 94, probably to help identify which languages should now be advanced. The submission in terms of Section 9.2, Section 9 of the Constitution deals with equality. And he's specifically looking at what we, in the constitutional language, call the qualification of equality or the amplification of equality in the allowance of affirmative action measures. And there he suggests a concrete proposal, which I've indicated in my opinion on page 2, paragraph 3. I'm not commenting on the drafting of that, because I think that the drafting in plain language is disastrous, but just on the principle that he wants to achieve there. And that principle pertains to that the affirmative action issue should be focused on creating work, creating decent jobs. And then later on he goes and seems to be focusing on public sector jobs. And on that principle I will now comment. I will just firstly look at what he uses in support of his arguments. In support of his amendment or his proposal in respect of Section 6, he's saying that official has in fact, I use the Latin there, de facto, in fact become the official working language of South Africa. He says it makes good common sense because it's also a language recognized internationally. Although he recognizes that it's critically important that all languages that are spoken should be nurtured and supported, he still focuses on languages, well, he doesn't say which languages those are, spoken prior to 1994, and use an example of the language is spoken by the, in legal terms, called the first people, the Sun and the Khoi people, and saying that they are marginalized by these provisions. I will deal with those arguments in my analysis, but in support of Section 9, he simply says that the issue of affirmative action should focus on career path development as constitutionally mandated by Section 195. Now, that's the system one I was commenting on. In analysis, and then also my comments on his proposal, Section 6, I was recently part of a court challenge against Parliament and the Minister of Arts and Culture and the President regarding the use of languages in the States. This is Lawrence versus President of the Republic of South Africa. Mr. Lawrence there challenged the use of English, or the predominant use of English, and various other, he also challenged the way Parliament publicised its legislation and so forth. But specifically was challenging the obligation in terms of Section 6 where there should be some kind of legislation that monitored the use of official languages. Only on that point there where he was successful. So the court said yes, the executive should introduce that language bill. It was introduced at one stage, or it was not introduced, but it was discussed by Cabinet. It hasn't moved further. So that is there should be now a piece of legislation that will come to Parliament in the next 18 months that monitors the use of language. In that court case, and that's what I want to amplify here, is that the court recognized that language is a very sensitive issue. the fact when one listens to the radio, languages has always been and is still today a very sensitive issue. In my view, or before I say that, I took the liberty and I just looked at Stats South Africa's latest census. Now, as I indicated in my opinion, that there's a very small part of South African population that uses English as a home language or that speaks it as a first language. So whilst I would agree from my practical experience, in fact, we speak a lot of English here in Parliament and everywhere, to go forward and put that in a constitution to say that the state should and must communicate predominantly in English is opening a can of worms which perhaps is left not to open. My reading of Section 6 at the moment, it allows government to use English and then another language as well. And that is what is happening. And we will probably see that when that Monitoring Act comes into operation and is implemented. And when that second language, or even the first two languages are used, the Constitution also sets out what should be taken into account. Amongst others, issues of regionality, issues of practicality, expense, and so on. Needs and preferences of the population as a whole and in the specific province when it relates to provinces. I find it quite sufficient. I'm not aware of any court case that said Section 6 is discriminating against any specific group. I also deal with the reference to the Khoisan languages, which is recognized as a language that needs support and development if one looks at Section 6.5. But Mr. Naidu doesn't deal with Section 6.5. But there is then, in other words, an obligation then specifically on the Standard South African Language Board to develop this language. In other words, there will be funding made available for people who are doing research on it, and I'm aware of certain programs that are in place to preserve this language, perhaps for historical reason, but also for practical use in those areas. So I find his comments that the Section 6 marginalizes the Khoisan community, I find them not supported by evidence. He doesn't really come forward and say that he has or he knows of people that cannot communicate with the state due to the invocation of Section 6. I deal with paragraph 10 of my opinion on page 4 on the issue of digital communication. I remember he's proposing that government should be obligated to promote digital communication. Now, whilst that I think is necessary in our modern age, you know, age of information as it was once called, I think now it's the age of the recession, that's not a constitutional issue for me. That should be addressed in a specific legislation that deals with digital communication. And as far as I'm aware, we have such legislation, but it doesn't put an obligation on the state to advance those kind of issues. From my practical experience, I think the issue of development and trade in any case forces people to use digital communication as well as the state to use. The issue of, we are very aware that the Constitution identifies 11 languages as official languages and then also says that other languages should be promoted. This idea of looking at languages that was there prior to 1994, I'm not sure how that is rationally connected to what we want to achieve in South Africa. In other words, transformation in South Africa. The transformation in South Africa for me has to do with undoing the wrongs of the past and in other words, respecting the language rights of people who are using those languages now and who were discriminated before. So I'm not exactly sure how that ties in, but I would leave it at that. In short, these submissions, in my opinion, on Section 6 doesn't hold water. I think Section 6 at this point in time is quite strong on the use of languages and allows government a considerable leeway to implement a language policy. In respect of Section 9, Honourable Chair, Section 9 is an equality clause that applies to all aspects of life in South Africa. It's been used widely by litigants in the Constitutional Court, as far as I'm aware, both in the labour sector, cultural sector, criminal law, death sentence, etc., etc. It's been used, it's been brought in at all areas. His proposal in terms of Section 9, in my view, seems to want to focus it firstly on the labour market and then secondly on the public sector labour market. And I think that can be addressed in legislation should one wants to address it in that way. It is addressed in any case in the policies, affirmative action policies, as far as I'm aware. And I find that his proposal in terms of Section 9 would dilute Section 9 as a broad a human right if it only applies to issues of employment. You know, in labor law, in any case, there's a gap in labor law where the labor rights of people who are unemployed are not really concretized. Now, if you want to take the equality clause in the Constitution and make it applicable to people who have work for career path development, as he says, it seems to take away certain of those rights that are there for people who don't have work, even people who cannot find work, whether they below the age of 16 or above the age of 16. So I'm not convinced of his proposal towards Section 9. As I said, I didn't comment on the drafting issues because if one looks at the drafting, of course, that's maybe from a layman. I don't know if he's a doctor of law or a doctor of medical science, but his drafting of, and I say it with respect, his drafting there seems to, first of all, take away other provisions. He wants to focus just on legislation, and it wants to look at only at persons and not categories of persons, which makes it, once again, a can of worms you don't really want to open, because it really means you have to look at individuals rather than groups when you're talking about affirmative action. Thank you, Chair. Mm-hmm. Questions for clarity?
Thank you. Congress, Chair. You know, this thing which was raised by Dr. Kornoff about the identity and where does this person come from, I understand it now. Really, because this thing, I think I'll wait when we debate this thing. Because this thing is sensitive, and I don't know whether this doctor understands this country. The majority of the people of this country, as I said, that I debated at that point in time, but to me, this is not acceptable. Sir.
May I, thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I
debate the merits? May I debate the merits?
No, we're not debating.
Can I make a comment on the merits, as the colleague did? No, just because I think that the submission is clear. But this is and I agree with what Advocate Jenkins said, in terms of our review of the Constitution, that's one of the most difficult issues. Significantly enough, the Constitution of Zimbabwe says that English is the official language, even though it's not spoken by anyone there, but people, minority people. Secondly, the first draft of the South African Constitution of 1993, I mean, the first proposal said English would be the official language and then there would be other languages to be promoted. And when the National Party said, no way, we're going to war on this, then Afrikaans had to become an official language and all the other languages had to be equally official languages. I mean, English is not my language, I'm just trying to use it, as most of us do. But the fact is that this issue will need to be revisited, because 11 official, there is no other country in the world with 11 official languages, which means there is no official language. But I think we need to wait another 15 to 20 years, and then those of us who will be there will need to reconsider that issue then.
Yeah, in the world, except this one. Bloom?
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. It's a comment. You see, the point that Kumbesi Sibo has raised, the criteria, is very much important. I need some guidance from you. I've never in this moment. But I don't understand what criteria are we using to deal with a submission? When a submission is coming in, is there any screen of that submission? Is anybody open to submit any document? Chairperson, you see, the reason why I'm asking, resources of let's say government or parliament. You see, I'm looking at now at legal advisors sitting here dealing with this thing. And many of the members have expressed now the issue of criteria and how we are dealing. You know, we must, maybe we must take one day, Chairperson, also for you to brief us, brief you of the committee's working and how submission is being dealt and divided upon. Thank you.
I just want to make one comment that if you're going to set a criteria, which means you are going to disadvantage other people, other South Africans, to make submissions, in my view, any other person, as long as South African, can make submissions to the committee as far as policy is concerned. So if we say this category of people, we're already discriminating other people. So I think what you need to perhaps say, we should think about how do we make sure that the person is South African. Otherwise, if we're going to set other criteria, then we already discriminating other people to make a submission, so to add their views.
No?
You see, Chairperson, I hear what you're calling.
Yeah, that members are not in a hurry to leave for,
yeah, no,
or anywhere. So
this one is very important. Yeah, let's get it clear.
Yes.
You see, to know that Dennis Bloom is a South African citizen, it's fine. But Dennis Bloom can also submit something, a document on behalf of a Zimbabwean in the name of Dennis Bloom.
and then
we are discussing this thing. I'm saying we must have a criteria. The issue that the committee and we can't debate it here, and we can't discuss it. I'm saying, proposing that we have a day and review the process. Thanks, sir.
Committee, I disagree with the issue of the criteria. What I'll rather go for is look at the merit of the submission, not the criteria.
I think it was a thing, it should be a South African citizen. And then we look at the merit.
Just give the ID number and address.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with, sorry, I don't remember your, the hash, I'm sorry, you have the hash. No, it's absolutely true. We should not be concerned with the messenger, with the message. There are lots of people out there highly qualified with lots of degrees, and they can deliver a very cranky message to us asking us to consider things that none of us want to consider, and they are off the wall. Conversely, there could be somebody from the most remote rural areas who can have, bring to our attention something on which we should apply our mind. The fact is we need to have a selecting process. We cannot have all these honorable members of parliament, all these highly paid advocates, all the structure of parliament. Sorry. I'll take that back. Sorry. I mean, all us considering what some of these are crank ideas, and we know we wouldn't consider them.
There being no more comments or questions for clarity, we proceed to the next submission, which is submitted again by R. Naidu. The advice is presented by Atikaru, Advocate Atikaru. Committee left 3, that is 2, reference number 7310. Atikaru.
Thank you. Good morning, committee members. My name is Zureya Adikari. I have broken my submission up into two documents. One, the reference 73, deals with section 192 of the Constitution. In the submission, Dr. Naidu points out that the Constitution, Section 192, which deals with the broadcaster, should incorporate in the provision some more prescriptive provisions relating to content and procedure, and so that it could be ensured to be incorporated into broadcasting legislation. His point is based on the fact that the Section 192 has not kept pace with frequent changes in technology for broadcasting and ICT. And he also wants to redress monopolies that exist in the industry. Now, whilst Mr. Naidu may be correct that technology frequently changes, this is exactly why provisions such as these do not go into a constitution, provisions that actually prescribe content and so on, because of the nature that they frequently change, and which means that we would frequently have to change the constitution. So the submissions from Mr. Naidu are provisions that should correctly be informing legislation. And so in my view, it's perhaps a submission that the committee would want to send to the communications committee.
See, this proves the point that even Naidu can prompt some valuable discussion. Okay. Section 192, and I wish our colleagues, Matt, were here, but I think that there is consensus that it needs to be amended. And I think it would be, and I need to go back to the terms of the debate, but once there is clarity on what they were, and there was a draft constitutional amendment floating around, it might be a good poll, politics, but it would be good for this committee to recommend to the Assembly and to both chambers that it be amended, just to see what happens. And it should be amended in two terms, in two ways. I think that the name of the commission, with the Independent Broadcasting Commission, is to be amended to the independent, to what ICASA is. And I do agree on the point raised by Dr. Naidu. 192 wants to guarantee the independence of broadcasting, but it has fallen short of bringing about the freedom of communication. South Africa is characterized by communication monopolies, especially on the airways. It is possible that somebody will bring a constitutional case declaring them illegal, as it happened in my native Italy.
You do understand what Ryan Naidu is making say, because that is the purpose now, to understand the submission and also to understand the legal advice.
Yeah, I
wanted to discuss the merits of the submission.
I understood them both, and I was discussing the merits. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I assure you.
Okay.
Any more comments? There being none, then let's proceed to the next one. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I ask in advance to be excused as soon as I've completed, because I'm required at the Speaker's office. So I'll just conclude my business, and if I may be excused.
But I was required at the Chairperson's office. Yeah. No, it's fine. Which one do you want to present?
I will do Section 216.
Section 216. Which document is that?
Reference 93.
Reference 93.
And then I have committee reference 7 as well, which is 94.
Reference 93. Yes. Do you all have reference 93? and the other one is what? Reference who? What?
The other one is reference 94 and committee reference 7.
Do we have that?
No.
I think that's attached to one of the others. It's backed onto the document with... it's at the back of the document with Constitutional Review 6. I see it's stapled to the back of this.
Thank you.
that again? Yeah. What references are you using?
I'm going to look at our office reference 93 and 94.
93 and 94, oh, okay. All right.
If I may, you may accept your order.
Okay.
In reference 93, we again deal with a submission from Dr. Naidu. Dr. Naidu's submission here is in respect of Section 216 of the Constitution. Dr. Naidu proposes that the word sustainable be inserted into the text of Section 216. The point that he makes is that there's very little emphasis on the necessity for expenditure in the Constitution. It simply sets out process, but that makes it often unsustainable. So he's concerned that there are not sufficient checks and balances in place to assess whether or not the money has been used in a sustainable manner, and therefore request that the committee consider inserting the word sustainable into Section 216. That, in my view, is whether or not it's appropriate is, in my view, a policy decision. I think our legislation does actually achieve that purpose.
So you can't just leave it open like that. We need your advice as to whether or not it's necessary for that goal to be achieved, or the Constitution to be amended.
What my recommendation is that the Constitution not be amended to include this word. It's a term that is quite vague and would take on a different context in different circumstances, and that our legislation adequately has checks and balances in place, if that is what Dr. Naidu wishes to address.
The advice you are giving us seems to be to say you might want to consider inserting the word sustainable, which is what he's asking us to do.
Well, that is a policy decision. You know, it's not, in my view, it's not going to change the, it's not going to have much substantive effect.
Okay. I'm confused.
Yeah, well,
We know that you can't direct us what to do, but you need to advise us.
Yeah,
to
in my view, it's not necessary, Chairperson. In my view, it's not necessary. But so I simply indicate that it's the committee's prerogative to discuss it.
I think what the chairman is asking, if I understand correctly, is whether or not it is necessary to amend the Constitution to achieve what Dr. Naidu wishes to be achieved, irrespective of how good it is. So that's a strictly a legal issue. If to bring about what Mr. Naidu wants, is it necessary to amend the Constitution?
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Maybe like what you were trying to get from the advocate to say, you are saying it's done, we achieve the purpose. Is it because of, let's say, the Minister of Finance or Treasury is me, and I move from the current clause that is there in the Constitution, will I also ensure that the country achieves all that? Because you're saying to ensure sustainability. So if we have another person becoming a treasurer, will it cover what you are still achieving now in terms of expenditure? So whether it's there or not, we'll still achieve, whether we change phases or we change the leading part, will it still, if the sustainability is not there, if inserting, it's not there, what is it, will it still be okay?
Thank you, Chair. In the penultimate paragraph, I indicate that spending through effective oversight is actually the way to ensure that spending is done in a sustainable manner. And in my view, these are issues that should be spelled out in legislation. I would have to just look at. I think
what you wished for was that you say that in the document.
Okay.
That legislation would be a better place to deal with this content rather than an amendment of the constitution.
Yeah, I think the amendment would be superficial.
I'm saying that should be said in your written legal language.
Sure, yeah. I'll make an amendment.
Okay. Let's proceed to the next one. The next one would be committee reference 7, reference number 94, stroke 10.
This submission was made by the National House of Traditional Leaders. It was a late submission. And the proposal that the National House of Traditional Leaders make is in respect of Section 211 and 212 of the Constitution. In respect of 211 of the Constitution, it's proposed that the section includes that a guarantee for the institution of traditional leadership. And furthermore, that Parliament undertakes not to legislate on anything that would withdraw the recognition on such institutions. Now, it appears to me from the submission that they are seeking perpetual existence, which, in my view, no constitution guarantees perpetual existence of anybody or any institution. And to the extent that the provisions pertain to entrenching this policy in the constitution, I think it's a matter of this is a matter for the committee to consider whether it's desirable to have such an institution guaranteed in the Constitution. The proposal relating to Section 212 relates to seeks to include the provisions that the Traditional Leadership and Government Framework Act, insofar as it relates to the role and functions of the traditional leaders, into the Constitution in Sections 19 and 20. So, in other words, they want these two provisions that are in the Act incorporated into the Constitution. And in my view, insofar as they are in relevant legislation, that is sufficiently appropriate. And however the committee may wish to consider whether to incorporate it again into the Constitution.
So what are you suggesting that we consider not amending the Constitution?
I think this is a policy decision that I cannot give you advice on, that you actually need to deliberate whether it is desirable to have an institution entrenched in the Constitution.
Yes, I will only address the submission and not the merits. Constitutions do exactly that. They entrench things in perpetuity until the Constitution is amended. The office of the president, parliament, the office of the public protector, etc., etc. The debate on traditional leadership, which goes on to 92, was about entrenching or not entrenching the powers of traditional leaders. The interim constitution said that the status of traditional leaders was entrenched. Traditional leaders understood the status meaning powers and functions. In the certification judgment, which did not entrench the powers and functions, the Constitutional Court said, sorry, the word status doesn't include powers and functions. And since then, there has been a 20-year debate which I'm not going to recall here because it's too long, in which there's been promises made and discussion about entrenching the powers and sanctions. So I think that in order to achieve what...
You're likely to put me in a difficult situation.
No.
It must be said I allowed you to go into the merits of...
No, not the merits. No, just in the merits of the submission. In order to achieve what the House of Traditional Leaders wants, right or wrong that it may be, and I'm not supporting, I'm not going to the merit, it would be necessary to amend the Constitution.
Are you covered?
Thank you very much. No. You see, in the first submission, when the advocate was...
You're sitting behind the others now, making decisions for me.
I am saying, in the first submission, you have asked the advocate to give legal advice. You see, there's two opinions here. The one, you are saying this is in my view appropriate, and then you leave it to us at the last paragraph again. The chairperson has asked, what advice, legal advice, are you giving to the committee? Thank you.
Yeah, as we progress in our discussions, I do seem to understand the advisor's difficulties at times. But the main question still remains as to whether, for the desired thing to happen, there's a need for the Constitution to be amended, or whether it is sufficiently covered in other legislation. But then again, if you say for it if you are of the view that for that goal to be achieved, indeed the Constitution will have to be amended, then that will be left to the committee to decide. It becomes a policy issue, really. It is a policy decision to be taken. That's why I'm saying I'm sort of understand the times, their difficulties. That's just my comment. You may want to respond.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mentioned that to the extent that provisions that pertain to entrenching institutions or policy issues, they must be considered by the committee and the relevant portfolio committee. That is my conclusion in the opinion. So I am actually saying that the committee must decide whether it is desirable to entrench this in the constitution. That in respect of 211, the concluding paragraph there. In respect of 212, I conclude to say that the sections that relating to role and function is appropriate in the legislation, in my view. However, there the committee may also wish to consider the merits of incorporating those provisions into the Constitution.
Do these provisions in the Act provide?
And that's what I'm saying. The Act provides for them. It's appropriate, in my view. I'm saying the proposal...
They are proposing inclusion of provisions in the Act.
It's a provision setting out the entire list of roles and functions of traditional leaders. Do you want such detail in the Constitution? And that, I'm saying, that kind of detail is appropriate in the legislation.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
On a point of correction, because we need to get yes or no answers, and this pussyfooting doesn't help anyone. And here there is a very clear yes or no answer. Do we need to amend the Constitution in order to entrench? Yes. Otherwise, it's not entrenched. Answer is yes. Do we need to amend the Constitution to have those powers entrenched? The answer is yes. Is there going to be necessarily a long list? Not necessarily. The word existing powers towards does it. So irrespective of the merits, the answer to both questions, I submit, are yes and yes.
My answer to the first question would be a yes, and my answer to the second question would be a no, that such detail is appropriate in legislation in respect of the second answer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I really want to take clarity on this point.
Still
speak on the basis that the MN requires you to speak.
Sorry.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologies. I was asking. But on clarity, because we need to have clarity. They say put this list in the Constitution, irrespective of the merits. The advocate says this is not appropriate. There's not a legal opinion. I mean, we have a list of powers for the municipalities. We've got Schedule B for all the powers of the municipality. We've got a list of powers for provinces. If we want to have a list of powers for traditional leaders in the Constitution, we can very well have it, and it's not the appropriate or not appropriate. It's not a consideration from a legal viewpoint. It's a policy consideration.
Point taken, Mr. Chair.
There have been no more comments or questions. Let's allow you to go and see the speaker. Which other... What is the next document you want to present to us?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to the Chair and honourable members of the committee. The submission in reference 4 is that of Mr. Mia. The first part of the submission Mr. Mia seek an amendment of section 165 subsection 3 and 182 subsection 3 of the Constitution. By these suggested amendments, we intend to extend the powers of the public protector to include powers to investigate court decisions. Perhaps I need to just brief the committee on what is entailed in sections 165.3 and 182.3. 165.3 prohibits any interference with the functions of the court by organs of state or individuals. And 182.3, which deals with the public protector, also prohibits the public protector, yes, 182.3 prohibits the public protector from investigating court decisions. Now, what Mr. Mia is suggesting is to allow the public protector to investigate court decisions. His argument is that such an amendment would enable state institutions supporting constitutional democracy to protect and strengthen democracy in South Africa and to prevent any branch of government from monopolizing political power. Mr. Mia further argues for an amendment of section 196, subsection 4. Basically, that section deals with the Public Service Commission, and he wants that section to be amended to include powers of the commission to improve service delivery at local government. I must say that at this stage, in my view, the Public Service Commission powers do not cover local government jurisdiction. The extension of the powers of both the Public Protector and the Public Service Commission are matters that the committee itself would have to decide. I make the point that in my understanding of 182.3, I differ with Mr. Mia's interpretation of that particular section. Because in my view, 182.3 has no negative effect on the public protector's performance of its functions.
Thank you. Questions? Clarity? Indeed, any comments? is asking that the Public Service Commission also deals with local government. And what is your response to that? He's saying his powers do not allow him to do that, to not allow the commission to do that. And if that is the case, isn't that exactly what he's asking for, that the constitution must be amended in order to cover that level of government?
Honorable Chair, it is correct that the Public Service Commission's mandate currently doesn't extend to local government. However, it's difficult for lawyers. Lawyers, when you read legislation, you read what is in front of you. You don't understand what is in the legislation, does not tell you why this particular policy decision was taken. It might seem an anomaly that local government is not included, because we know that there are problems at local government when it comes to service delivery. I would not see any difficulty with the extension of the mandate of the Public Service Commission to include local government service delivery. However, there could be other policy considerations that I'm not aware of. But from a legal point of view, I would not have a problem with the extension of the mandate.
It's difficult in you saying that, especially if there are no other considerations that may negate that view. The only one you have is the one that is no problem with these powers being extended. Lloyd?
Honorable Chair, what I wouldn't want to do is to think that legal reasons are the only basis for doing things. There could be, that is why I make the point that the committee could entertain this particular issue.
You say yourself that there are problems in the local government, sphere of government. And indeed, there doesn't appear to be any reason why the powers of the commission do not extend there. Now, you want to rely on some other reasons that you are not aware of in giving us direction. You're not giving us direction. Because if you believe that there's nothing to be offended, as far as you can see, by amending the constitution in order to cater for what this submitter wants to be catered for, then you should be. Why is it difficult to say that? Why do you take into consideration something that is not there, that you are not aware of, that might have necessitated the exclusion of that particular sphere of government?
I take your point, Honorable Chair, and perhaps as I say that from a legal point of view, I do not see and a legal impediment. And I take the point that perhaps I should have been specific on that regard.
It does appear as if therefore the advisors are aware of the kind of advice we are looking for from the interaction we've been having with all of them.
No pushing, footing, and precise.
The final decision is ours. We are not going to blame you when we take a decision which is to be found later to be wrong. But Nina, as they said, no pushing, footing, that's the key, and make it easy for us. As was said, we're not lawyers. Let's proceed, therefore, to this submission was five. Oh, are you all taking all that by your name, Vanna?
No, five would be dealt with my colleague.
I don't know if you want to take six.
Oh, six, yes.
Because it says your name. Unless the sequence is important.
No, it's not important, Chair. Just to comment, Honorable Chair, on your last point. Perhaps you had the advantage of sitting in this committee last year when we were deliberating on the submissions of 2009. And we tried to take some of the lessons learned in that exercise, and it would seem that what we learned there is what basically the committee wants us now to go back to that position. But thank you, sir. We take note of you.
We were not there, Chairperson.
What are you talking about? We were not there. Maybe if he get, if you and him get
there. Honourable Chair, the next submission that I dealt with was from Mr. Mutsuneng, who argues for an amendment of Section 34 of the Constitution that deals with the current judicial system, the structure of the current judicial system. In his view, in the structure that he is amending, the Magistrates Court Act, the Supreme Court Act, are too technical for someone not trained in law, and thus deprive people access to justice. In his suggested judicial system, the community courts will replace the Magistrates Court, and high courts will replace the Human Rights Court, and the Supreme Court of Appeal will be replaced by the Constitutional Court with a broader jurisdiction. Now, some of the issues that Mr. Mutsuneng is touching on, I think there are currently developments in some of the issues that he has raised. However, the difficulty with his submission, he does not give a synopsis of how this alternative judicial structure he is suggesting would function. And again, the question of an alternative judicial system, Honorable Chair, is a policy matter that the committee would have to decide. There are, in my view, challenges for people to access justice. And I know that the government has, through the legal aid, try to access justice, and the Department of Justice, I'm aware, has got certain programs to try and make justice accessible to the people. If that is sufficient, it's difficult for me to judge because I'm not an active participant. And that's why I say it will be open for the committee to consider this particular exercise.
What I suggest or point
out, Chair, is if the committee were to accept an alternative judicial system, in my view, Section 34 of the Constitution would not necessarily be amended. What would perhaps, or the effect of that decision, would have an impact on Chapter 8 of the Constitution and the relevant legislation that will flow from such an alternative judicial system.
You made mention of the fact that the legal aid the board does assist people to get access to justice. Does that mean that if my opponent engages the senior counsel, the legal aid board will allow me to have senior counsel so that there's equality in the representation that takes place in the particular matter?
Honourable Chair, whilst I was in practice, those considerations were taken into account, and that the applicant, if the legal aid board did not have the sufficient resources, there were other means of appointing a senior counsel, either on a pro bono basis or the heavy judge instructing some counsel to assist a particular litigant. As I say, whether that in general, because what we need to understand, the legal aid board mainly assists in criminal matters. There are civil cases which are not necessarily covered, and I recently read a document where the legal aid board was trying to open a call center to advise people on divorce matters and maintenance issues, because those are not issues that the mandate currently allows them to do. So there is a shortfall in terms of that accessibility.
That shortfall, can it be addressed by the amendment of the Constitution as suggested or not?
Honorable Chair, I don't think that amending the Constitution would be the answer. I think what the Constitution, as far as I'm concerned, gives everyone access to justice. But the question is, how do you give effect to that particular constitutional effect or provision? I think that is where the problem lies.
Okay, I have my own issues about this equality before the law and the private legal representation that they face. Any questions? Seems as if it's
clear. You know what was my proposal was? We take it to the MGC next month.
That does show that that's a national entity. That the party entity. Even other parties are looking up to that entity.
I know that you are going to review the justice system. Take it there, Chairman.
Okay. I think we should outlaw the legal profession and solve all the problems.
yes, no?
I will ask Dr. Kunov also to take it to their conference in September, COPE's conference. I would also.
I thought you meant the man, the one that matters is the one that is taking place.
Don't ask me to take it to our conference. We're having problem having one.
Okay. Now let's proceed to, thank you, Mr. Vanara. I take it, as I said, all of you will have a relook at the advices you've given us and so that you take into account what you said just now. I hear what you say, they said it before, but this is now. This is politics. But then, committee reference 5, reference number 7510.
Thank you, Chairperson. The petitioners are from an organization called Projects Abroad, so I don't know if you consider the submission within the bounds. They might not be citizens. In any event, the petitioners are saying that Section 27 of the Constitution, which provides for socioeconomic rights, i.e. the right to access to health care, sufficient food and water, and social services, are inadequate. They argue that unlike civil and political rights, socioeconomic rights are left deliberately vague, and as such they're difficult to enforce. They express the view that problems in the enforcement of socioeconomic rights are caused by the separation of powers between the judiciary and the executive. In this regard, they said that the court can only consider cases on a case-by-case basis, and that would be a problem. But that, I think they recognize that it's not feasible to change that. And in essence, they conclude that the South African Human Rights Commission can play a more effective role in the realization of the socioeconomic rights, and that it might be more feasible for litigants in these cases to request structural interdicts, which ensure that government implements decisions of a court. In this regard, they do not propose amendments of the Constitution.
I don't know whether we should not read an implicit request, and there is a debate. The debate basically suggests that the Human Rights Commission should issue a report. Constitution should give it the power to issue that report, and that we reach a point of development in our society in which the right to habitation is a right. You don't get house, you sue government. The right to shelter is the right. You don't get shelter, you sue the government. And I think that's it's not explicitly requested, but I would think that that perhaps is what the proponent was asking. I'm not sure.
They do make the point that socioeconomic rights are deliberately vague, but you cannot insist on having a house if it's not within the available resources. And that is the problem. That's why it is left vague. There are criteria, certain courts have used the criteria of reasonableness under the circumstances. I mean, there have been three cases in that regard. The first case is Subramani, where somebody needed a kidney. And the court looked at that and said that to provide this person, it was not sustainable because they just didn't have the facilities to do so. The other cases dealt with the Krootbom case, which was the right to housing, and last was the tax judgment which dealt with ARVs. In that case, the court said basically that government has sufficient funds to roll out ARVs to prevent mother-to-child transmission, because it only costs $1 a tablet. Now, that's the criteria, and obviously it is vague. You cannot say that I have a right to housing and give me a house. It's different when your right to vote is infringed. You know, everybody has that right. But it's just the economics of that, and it's based on the progressive realization of those rights. And courts do take those factors into consideration. Unfortunately, it is only a court that can look at those issues, because it's not a certainty. And it's also difficult for a court to sit and evaluate, really, has government gone far enough? Because it's not as if you, in simple terms, that you spend your whole, if you look at an individual, that you spend your whole salary on food, because everybody has that. And government has to break that up between defense, education, etc. So that's why the vagueness changed.
Yes, just first of all, I can try it, and the advocate is absolutely correct. It's quite is built in all the long constitution. But if one looks at the TAC case, the petitioner said, I didn't get the drugs, I'm sick, I'm suing you for violation of my right to health. The government came in and raised the issue, not of money, of capabilities. We love to, we don't have the capabilities. The court is blind. They cannot go and determine whether the capabilities exist or don't exist, how much money the government has. The case was won for one reason and one reason only, and I'm trying not to gloat, because the province of KwaZulu-Natal intervened and said, wrong, we have the capability, it can be done, we are doing it. But had the province of KwaZulu-Natal not intervened, the crucial piece of information, the court would have had no resources of its own to take cognizance of the fact that the capability existed and therefore order the government to give the drugs. And what this debate suggests is that there be an independent mechanism, say the Human Rights Commission, which determines at what point those capabilities exist. Now we are rich enough that nobody should not have nevirapine, mother-to-child transmission. We will reach a point where we are going to be rich enough that everyone should have water as a matter of right, or electricity as a matter of right, or shelter as a matter of right, and go on and so forth. So it's a debate that we need to keep in mind, and I would tag it as something to be considered further, Mr. Chairman.
You want to come in again?
Just a point of clarity. What they suggest is not that the Human Rights Commission not work in that manner, rather that the Commission play a more active role in litigating and getting involved in those issues. The problem that you're going to have is that if you tell, although that is the mandate of the Commission is also independent. So you will have to deal with that kind of difficulty. Although that is, I just want to clarify that was not the suggestion of the petitioners, that the Human Rights Commission act as a body, but rather to oversee that, but rather to play a more active role in litigation where that's needed.
There aren't any comments or questions. Either it's too involved or too key, simple to understand. Okay, no, thank you very much to the legal advisors. We'll meet you when next we meet. Sure, they'll be informed. Yeah. We will like to meet us when we deliberate and do submissions. Yeah, now you're excused.
Do we want to proceed or do I have to take a break? There's no coffee anymore. Is there coffee out there? Let's continue. Let's proceed to the minutes of the last meeting.
Then we can't. He wants to go, so we must. If we want to take the sessions, we must take now the sessions.
Yeah, I know. You need to take decisions, and you need a Quran. And nobody wants to break a Quran. Which means these minutes have been circulated for members to make comments, to make corrections. You don't just, when you are given minutes or documents, it's not for you to keep them until you come to the meeting. You are free to interact with the secretary and make and suggest corrections, especially corrections of non-policy nature. So, page one, any corrections? Anybody's name wrongly spelled or somebody said to be present when he was not present? Page one.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, point of order. Wonder whether you can accommodate a fool like me who left the minutes in the office.
Okay.
Can you give him some minutes? Minutes of the 13th of...
The office version is the wrong one.
That's full of it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Page one. Any corrections? Two. Any correction? Three. Any correction? Four. I think there is a correction. On page four, the fourth paragraph, one, two, three, four. The fourth line from the bottom, the sentence reading, she registered the importance of making use of the information. We need to put in that word off the information which the committee already had. Then further down, next paragraph, last line, the skills and information that were at its disposal instead of what. Those are the corrections I noted there. Anyone else? Okay, page five, any corrections? Here again, the paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The line that begins with however, should the committee agree that the submission requires a constitutional amendment, requires instead of require, submission requires. That's the only correction I saw on that page. Anyone else? Page 6? Any correction? Page 7? Anyone then proposing the adoption of the minutes? Is a correct reflection of what happened? It's actually seconded by Bloom. Any matters arising? Say on page one. To be systematic on page two. On page three. Matanyana wanted to be able to leave on time. Page four. page five. Oh, I see. I was looking.
You can see that now you are rushing to airport.
No, I'm
not. Yeah, Chairperson, the matter arising. It's the matter that is placed in your hand to meet with the House Chairperson. Can I get progress?
Yes, indeed. I did meet the House Chairperson, Mr. Mapela. He is going to give us a response in the course of next week, maybe by Wednesday. It does look like we are likely to get permission to take this tour, provided that we are not leaving at the time when... Provided, first of all, that's what he said. Our committee is not going to be dealing with the supplementary budget.
because committees will be looking at that, and at a later stage, that supplementary budget will be voted upon. So by at the time that it has to be voted upon, we have to be here. Now, I'm not sure now of the date, but I did point out to him that while our committee doesn't do that kind of work, the joint committee doesn't necessarily oversee any portfolios. But the only question that remaining now is the question of whether we are not all going to be required to be there here at the time. I mean, whether the date of the visit is not clashing with the time when we are supposed to be. The date, who remembers? Do you remember the date? The date of the visit. Also, the question of funds. He was also to look into that, because we didn't manage to get any body outside of Parliament to assist us with the funding. Does anyone remember the date of the visit in October? From 13 to 26th. It's likely to clash with that time. No? Or does anyone know when the appropriations, what you call bill, will be?
The date again, is it October, November?
End of October. When 27 October. Yeah, 27 October. Our committee doesn't review the budget. Yes. No.
Now that we've got the dates, and I would propose that we, even if you are needed in the House, I don't think that the 20-something, no, 15 or 12 from the NA will make an impact in terms of affecting the vote when they call for division. Yeah. So I would propose that we move with those dates.
I'd rather that we wait until the chairperson gives us his definitive response as to whether or not indeed we are going ahead, because it depends on a number of factors. And if there are difficulties, I'm sure you will want to engage us, the chairperson. Are we in a position to decide now definitely?
Yeah, Chair. Firstly, maybe. You, between yourself, the co-chairpersons, and the secretary, you can look at the fourth term program before Wednesday, so that as and when he comes back to yourself, you are aware of whether there is a need of shifting the date, because there are no major, because I know the president is speaking in November 26, whatever it is. So you will be saying, you'll be knowing exactly to say this can impact on this or not, so that we're not also saying, well, we'll come back to you when you come back to him after 2 weeks, and October is just next to the corner. Yeah.
Another thing, I think we have to look at is the number of the delegation because of the funding.
Yeah, that minute will get a report from the secretary, because on page 5, it was proposed that the secretariat should establish a formula applied for the composition of the delegation for joint committees on study tour. Previously, we had to rely on Mr. Watson. But before we go there, let's exhaust the one about...
Mr. Chairman, two things, if I may. First of all, I think that in our interaction with the Office of the Speaker, the Chairman of Committees should be brought to bear that we are complying with an invitation of an international institution created by treaty, where the members of the institution are sovereign states, and we are going there, or you are going there, to their annual general meeting. So that is what it is and when it is. It's not a matter of doing it before or afterwards.
Yeah, no, I think that's
the one thing. Then the other, if you, with your indulgence, if I had a proposal which is very little obscene and I'm surely unpopular, but it is an important interaction and a demanding interaction because we are going to meet there, or you're going to meet there, the best constitutional lawyers from all over the world are going to ask questions, etc. I went for a 3-day workshop on public enterprise in a hotel here next door, which was required or not required, it's a matter of opinion. But if we take 3 days, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and we go in a hotel here and we do this review of the Constitution, I don't want to amend the Constitution. I'll tell you very frankly, I don't think there is anything to be amended in the Constitution, perhaps with the exception of the issue of traditional leadership. But I think that if we go through this effort and produce a document which shows what are our aspects and what we have discussed, and we engage our counterparts on the basis of that document, we will have done justice both to our job and to the trip.
Well, you're suggesting let's have a workshop of some kind,
yeah,
in preparation for our interaction with the Venice Commission. Oh, I see. I think that's a view that you need to consider.
No, sir, I think you make a point that our trip especially is linked to the sitting of the Venice Commission, so it's not actually cannot change it.
Oh, okay.
No, I was making 2 points.
Yes.
Chair, I was advised that it is the chairpersons usually use their discretion on the number of members who will be going on the trip. And in terms of the NCOP, I didn't manage to get a concrete response on how they determine how the formula that they use, except to say that they usually determine members who will be going on the trip in terms of provinces.
That's not being helpful at all, because I am certain that seeing we now and again undertake these trips, whether nationally or internationally, there ought to be some kind of formula which determines how many members are supposed to come from each of the parties, and so, and also in terms of the funding that is available. I think more information needs to be sought. But yeah, the NCOP wants to clarify more.
No, Chairperson, you are correct. The task has not been done to its fullest. For instance, firstly, we don't have to go to House Chairperson. I don't know about that. And not knowing how much are we still having as budget from our committee, one. To say how much have we spent, and I think
it will help. The Mapela told me that international trips are not
outside
covered by the budget given to committees, because the budget for committees is too little.
Okay. Let me then continue. If that is the case,
that funding is in the speaker's Washoka, speaker's care, so it has to be applied for to the speaker. Yes, you may.
Chair. The speaker, for instance, we are 20, what, 30, how many are we? but I know that we are a big number, and not all of us will be able to go. But there is a formula that they use. It is not necessary that the NCOP chief whip or chairperson will decide from this team. It's a party to say with this trip party qualifies, given the fund that they would give us. The party qualifies for 15 or 10, and then the party then breaks that number in terms of how many from the committee. But you don't go back to the NCC and whatever. It's there. They have that thing.
That is the impression I always had, that there would be some formula. Because otherwise we'd have to discuss as to how many people in essence do we want to go. It can't be a decision by the chairperson without being informed by what the committee has to say. Bloom?
Yes, chairperson, written criteria, agreed in the chairperson's meeting. I know that criteria. And then we sit and go according to that thing. That thing is saying ANC 10, DA 2, and so on and so on. That's that document, I know.
No, he said retailers must find out more information, both with respect to the NA and the NCOP.
I'm requesting to be released, or else I'll miss my connecting flight to Polokwane.
Why did you live so far away from Tibet?
I was going to ask us if we can proceed because she wants to leave. And
we don't need to take any decision.
No decision.
Yeah, so
we don't need a doctor.
Let's
adopt the minutes.
In any event, the minutes have been adopted.
Oh, okay, then we don't need a quorum.
But then there's the report that has to be. Quickly, are there any other matters arising?
No.
There aren't. You sure? Okay. Let's proceed then to the report. Again, the report.
Can I have a copy?
The full. What did you call yourself again? The report quickly, it has been circulated to members. And I don't know if there were any comments or in terms of corrections that were forwarded to the secretary. On page 1, any corrections? Page 2, any corrections? 3, any corrections? 4, any corrections? 5, any correction? 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Any comments? Well, the comments I have are with respect to the decision we take as to what body a submission has to be made. Because in a number of instances, for instance, on page 4, at the bottom, it says the committee recommends that the matter be referred to it referred by it to the portfolio committee on public works and or the relevant department and submit as the advice. My suggestion was that let us say the submission is referred to the department, the relevant department, and the portfolio committee is informed so that they can keep track of that submission, and also the person making the submission informed accordingly. That is what has been decided with respect to her request. That's all I thought that needed to be corrected or amended. Of course, on page 8, submission 9 by N. Mary Robb. The conclusion is the committee recommends that the submitter should approach the registrar of any high court or the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for further explanation on issues of legal capacity status.
Sorry, I have a problem.
Whenever you're finished, Mr. Chairman.
I'm saying, why would you have wanted this person to go to the registrar of the High Court? Would that be the function of a registrar? I would have thought that this is sufficient for us to refer the matter to the Department of Justice, as I said earlier, and to take the matter in the manner suggested. But agreed on that. We take out the reference to register of the High Court, but remain in Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Those were just my observations that I believe ought to be attended. Otherwise, there was nothing else.
So I'm taking you back to page 6, and I don't want to open a can of herrings or worms, but on 5, children's rights. What is stated there is incorrect and doesn't reflect my recollection of the discussion. The Constitution does provide for the right to permit.
They may just adopt it and then agree that there will be amendments.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they need another committee.
How can you adopt it?
We do it all the time.
Okay.
Okay, let's try that. Who moves the adoption of the report subject to any amendments that we're going to be looking at? So see. Oh, and who? Second. Seconding. Oh, Bloom. All right.
The three or four people are going to be with it. Are going to be.
Number 10, proceed.
Well, page 6, but it doesn't matter. I mean, nobody reads these things, but page 6, all these things of abortion, it's. I mean, the Constitutional Court found the constitutional right to abortion as part of the right to privacy. So it's not in legislation. What the guy wanted to do was to amend the Constitution to eliminate the constitutional basis for the legislation to abortion. But leave it as it is. I just point out that it's not correct.
The way it is.
Well,
We cannot do anything different. It has been adopted, and we don't have a quorum to amend it. Okay, what we are saying here, the submission wanted to eliminate abortion in very simple terms. We say, sorry, abortion is in the law, not in the Constitution, and we refer it to health. In truth, the law is only implementing a constitutional right to abortion, which the Constitutional Court identified. So it would not be possible to amend the law without amending the Constitution. But now it's a done thing, so we can close the can.
Other comments, Loom?
Jefferson, the conclusion. This person, it's on fixed this conclusion. We are sending now this person to go and seek legal advice.
Yeah.
If the conclusion.
Oh, the conclusion. Okay, sir.
Yeah. Wish to challenge the provision of the choice of. We advise him to seek legal opinion.
Okay.
On. It is not correct. According to me, it's not correct.
To send that person.
We
retain all the person then.
Yeah.
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 But we
refer
it to the portfolio committee or to
yeah.
The department.
To the department.
To the
department.
Yeah.
Keep it out of the hands of the
politician. Yeah. To the department. Or do we simply reject the proposed amendment? Doesn't look like it's necessary to be wasting this person's time, giving the false impression that referring it to some other body is going to make any difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think our conclusion is that we don't believe that there's a need for a constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
So we change that the conclusion accordingly.
Yeah.
We are not referring it to any committee or any other body.
So not that bad. Well, that being the case, is there anything else? I think that's the last item on the agenda. Enjoy the weekend. The meeting is adjourned.
Long live the chair. Long live the chair. Take
care. You know, when you adjust the meeting, you should do what I used to do.